Ignition sequence start. 3, 2, 1.
Welcome back to University, everybody, the podcast where we explore the hard-hitting questions of Earth, existence, and the unknown. I'm AJ Perrin. With me, as always, is
Judson Martin.
And unfortunately, we're doing our first ever re-record. So I'm going to try to not to refer to everything in this episode as like an ode to a past conversation that we had about this. This is all fresh to you, but unfortunately not fresh to us. But that's okay. It's still going to be great. Today, we're talking about mass extinction events. How they happen, why they happen, if they're avoidable, and if we're living in a sixth one now. But before we get into any of that, we have to run through our news and our brain gains. Judd, what do you got?
So I ran into an interesting company called Astrolab. So they have a pretty cool mission of creating these rovers that are essentially like stand-on lawnmowers, if you've ever seen those. Like they have the knee pads and everything that you rest on. But they're going to build these so that we can use them on Mars and the moon as we're trying to get around, and we can move much more like scientific equipment around a lot faster. So these things can carry up to like 1,500 kilograms of the scientific equipment or whatever else we're trying to transport. They're going to partner with SpaceX to deliver Flex, which is the name of their rover, to the lunar surface in 2026. So it'll be riding up there on Starship. So that'll be pretty cool.
Yeah. And that lines up pretty much perfectly when we're planning to really be kicking things into high gear with the Artemis missions.
Probably going to make building some bases on the moon a lot easier if we can move that stuff around. I mean, it'll be just like...
Those rovers move, too. If you want to see a clip of them, you can run over to our Instagram where we might have posted a clip from Astrolab's YouTube channel there with Chris Hadfield, famous astronaut. Don't know if he's just a spokesperson or, you know, a significant engineer involved with that, but... him riding around on one of those. It's pretty cool.
Yeah, and there's other companies doing this as well. I know Lockheed Martin is making one that looks pretty similar to, it's almost like, it looks like a golf cart or like an ATV type of thing. But yeah, it's pretty interesting to think about the fact that we're now going to have like cars in space, you know?
Yep.
Other than the one Tesla that's cruising around somewhere.
The Roadster?
Yeah.
You believe that that was real?
That he sent it up there?
Yeah. Yeah. I think so too.
I don't think it's really a question of whether it's real.
Really? People on the internet will be like, they'll criticize the hell out of that GoPro footage.
Nah, that's real.
Anyway, yeah, just a useless piece of space junk, but it's there, yeah.
Yeah, and then it's not really, it's not floating around.
It's not in orbit.
Yeah, so. It's not in orbit, so it's not creating a problem. It's just going out there. There's something on there to contact aliens, I think, or something like that.
It's like Golden Record 2.0, but instead it's just a cherry red Roadster.
Yeah, and it's playing a one song on repeat all the time. I can't remember which one it is, but...
Other news, if you watched the solar eclipse today, I'm sure you were not able to experience the eclipse for as long as a couple pilots piloting some NASA jets did on that day. They had three jets from NASA equipped with scientific equipment that were basically chasing the eclipse to try to extend the amount of time that they were able to read scientific data. Up to almost 7 minutes, which is quite a long time because these jets can move at 500 miles an hour. But goals of the jets were to not only take pictures of the corona, which is useful, I found out, for spotting stray asteroids floating around the sun, because when you don't have all the light at once from the sun hitting any camera lens, you can spot those stragglers around the outer edge. And then also we want to measure data from the ionosphere and see, okay, without the sun, how do things change? That way we can better understand the impact that the sun has on our upper atmosphere. They're cruising at 50,000 feet, by the way. So not your typical commercial flight.
Those things are up there, yeah.
Yeah.
Pretty cool. They're halfway between, well, no, 50,000. Never mind. That's a different number. Anyway.
You think 50,000 meters and halfway to...
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, me too. Moving on, the moon is now going to be getting a time zone. The White House has directed NASA to work with government agencies to give the moon its own time zone. So we've got Central, we've got Pacific, Eastern, and now we've got what's called Coordinated Lunar Time, or LTC, stands for Coordinated Lunar Time. Anyway, they have until the end of 2026 to develop one, which lines up directly with the NASA Artemis missions of the same year. And you might be thinking, well, why do we need a time zone on the moon? This is because of relativity. So the easiest way to explain it is just that the stronger the gravity you experience, the slower you experience time. Now, if you're on the moon, you're experiencing time faster because it's less gravity than here on Earth. So you're losing about 58.7 microseconds each day if you had an Earth clock up there, right? Those clocks are going to get out of sync. Same thing with GPS satellites that are flying around the Earth really high up, is their clocks are going to alter, and so they have to make sure they're accounting for the time that they're losing. Now, the reason why we need that specific time zone beyond just relativity is that we need to make sure we're lining up our takeoff and landings on the moon. We need to make sure we're lining up our data transfers. Basically, anything autonomous that NASA's trying to do, they have to make sure that that's lined up correctly.
Yeah. I just missed a meeting earlier this week because I was having a meeting with somebody who's in a different time zone, and he had told me the time for the meeting, but he had told me the time in his time zone, didn't realize that I was in a different one. And so we didn't, you know, he showed up to the meeting at one time and I showed up another, and we didn't end up making it work. So,
and you said, my bad, I was in coordinated lunar time.
Yeah. And then I was just like, now there's another time zone I got to worry about.
Yeah.
Because we're going to be meeting with so many astronauts that are
exactly,
up in space.
That are, yeah.
And it's just going to be,
it's going to be a mess. I'm going to be a whole 58.7 microseconds behind on joining that meeting. So
what a pain. There's going to be a lot of latency going on in that. These Zoom calls that
we've dealt with way more than 58.7 microseconds. You remember that episode with Nate last summer where it was like all three of us were basically, it felt like we were in different. Yeah, it kind of was just me. But man, for me to be the one that was like recording, doing the mass recording of all of them, that was probably the worst choice because it was a lot of pain cutting that one up. Anyway, Arizona has, this is one of the bad things about re-recording is I get to, some of the questions that I wanted to ask you the first time, I just can't get that like natural reaction out of you. But anyway, Arizona names their state planet here. And I asked Judd last time, this is one of the times I will refer to an old conversation. I asked Judd, he named every single planet and he didn't get the one that Arizona named as their state planet. He named everyone in the solar system. And that's because they named their state planet a dwarf planet. It's actually Pluto is now the state planet of Arizona.
That's
and that's
dumb.
I'm in agreement. I kind of landed on both sides of the table. I was like, I can see why they did it, but I still don't think it's a planet. And here's why. So that's actually funny. Today's video that I posted on our Instagram had to do with Pluto not being a planet. Astronomer Percival Lowell founded the Lowell Observatory in Flagstaff, Arizona, and that was to help search for the ninth planet in the solar system. Ironically, he called this undiscovered planet Planet X, which X just stands for the undiscovered, but it also is funny that that's the Roman numeral 10, so one more than nine, but
he's dumb twice. He's dumb in two different ways.
Speaking ill of the dead, Judd. Yikes.
Oops, that's not good.
He found several potential ninth planets up until his death in 1916, but they never officially claimed one of them as the ninth planet, and then the observatory picked up this project again in 1929, so over a decade later. And a guy named Clyde Tombaugh found the planet, which ended up being Pluto. And so State Representative Justin Wilmoth introduced a bill, I think last week, to help recognize Pluto's role in Arizona history.
Yeah, you know, I have mixed opinions, but I'll allow it just this once.
Yeah.
If we catch Iowa, you know, naming some crazy planet like, I don't know, some other dwarf planet or maybe some moon or something.
Yeah.
I'm going to be upset.
Can you imagine K2-18b becoming our state planet, though? Like, that would be the planet to pick. If anything, states should be jumping on the state planet trend now so that they can pick the good ones before the good ones are all gone.
What's special about that planet?
That's the one that they detected traces of dimethyl sulfide, the compound in the atmosphere they were saying could only be produced by life, or at least here on Earth is only produced by life.
So that could be the one.
Yeah, we could end up picking the one that has life on it. Who knows? Next piece of news, we've got a new camera for investigating dark matter. Quick refresher, 95% of the mass energy in the universe is dark matter and dark energy. And those are things that we can't really directly observe. So we have to take lots of measurements and lots of giant pictures of the universe in order to better understand what they're doing behind the scenes. So the Legacy Survey of Space and Time Camera, or the LSST, has been recently developed. This is made by the same observatory where an astronomer, Vera C. Rubin, actually found the first evidence of dark energy. So a little bit of a coincidence, or dark matter. Now, this is a huge, huge camera that will be taking pictures with 3,200 megapixels, so about 320 times a typical camera today, or scaled 320 times greater. And it's also 6,000 pounds, which is actually a Guinness record for the largest camera, period, on the planet. So that is pretty interesting.
And big thing.
Yeah. In one picture, it will collect more galaxies than there are people here on planet Earth, and its data repository will be like 100 to 1,000 times larger than any collection of astronomical objects in the past. Now, the camera is in the process of being moved to Chile, where it's going to get thrown up into an observatory 8,900 feet above sea level. So they got to truck this $6,000 camera all the way up there. So you can imagine how painstaking that is to like not break anything. Yeah. A lot of bubble wrap.
Yeah.
That's all the news I had. Did we have more news than that?
I think that was it. I prefer packing peanuts over bubble wrap.
True.
It's a personal thing. But I also,
it can fit into volumes better. It can fill a volume.
Yeah,
more
nice
easily.
Packing efficiency. But at the same time, maybe I redact that. I mean, I want to say I like the bubble wrap so I can pop the bubbles.
True.
But they switched to those new ones.
They don't pop.
Yeah.
That's kind of when society declined.
Yeah.
You remember 2016, we had Harambe. We had the bubble wrap switch. I don't really think things have really been the same since then. So
no.
Minecraft caves and cliffs, like now the diamonds are at like negative 1,000 and 80, you know?
And it's they switched like, to netherite. It doesn't even look as cool.
The netherite episode is next episode, Judd.
Yeah.
So we're done with news. Let's get into brain gains. Judd, last time I asked you, again, referring to an old conversation, I asked you, what language do deaf people think in?
Yeah, and I tried
to
think.
And you said what? And then pretended to be deaf.
Yeah, and I said what and tried to be deaf. I remember that now.
Yeah.
What?
Okay.
Anyways, it's not the same. I don't know.
Yes, you do.
I do know now, but I'm going to pretend I don't.
So, well, let me tell you then. Deaf people actually think in sign language. So they visually see sign language in their head. Or actually, I don't know if it's a mixture of seeing it in their head, but also imagining like the muscle movements to sign things out. But anyway, that's how they think, every single thought that goes through their head. And on top of that, if someone who was born deaf was taught to speak through vocal training, and granted, this is probably not the case for people who go deaf later in life. Anyway, if someone was born deaf but was taught to speak through vocal training, they'll actually think in spoken language. So not how it sounds, but how it feels to speak those words. Judd, what's your brain gains?
So this week we were talking about rotating detonation engines. So this is a new type of engine that's going to go on like spacecraft. It's a rocket engine, not necessarily like an airplane engine or anything like that. But a current rocket engine, we just pump out a bunch of, there's two different ways to do it, but these ones would be fluid engines rather than solid rocket engines. But it has a constant stream of the fluid that goes out of the nozzle at the end. But this rotating detonation engine, instead of having a constant stream, it goes around a circle around the outside. So there's instead of a constant detonation around this entire rocket nozzle engine, there's just one detonation that's traveling around the outside of the nozzle. This is burning less fuel, therefore making it more efficient while still also producing similar amounts of thrust. Because while this detonation isn't occurring everywhere all at once, a lot of the residual heat and energy from the explosion is still lingering around that area, so it's still able to propel the fluid out of the engine at similar speeds, therefore generating similar amounts of thrust.
Because I was going to say, that was the question I had last time, was like, does it produce the same amount of thrust? But you're saying because the heat doesn't go away immediately, it's still, for the most part, producing significant thrust while the detonation travels around in a circle.
And I should say, like, the detonation is traveling. Like, you can't even see with the naked eye that this is traveling around the circle.
It's
like,
fast.
It's very, very fast. You can look up a video of it. NASA posted a video of a test for it. But
does it have a cool ignition? Like, does it look cool while it ignites? I can kind of see it start to travel. Like a wheel spinning, and then all of a sudden, you just can't even tell that it's spinning because it's going so fast? Or is it not like that?
No, it's pretty instant.
Well, I'd recommend, if you want to take a look, just, like, get yourself underneath a booster and just stare straight up. And see if you can see for yourself.
Yeah, get close enough to like really see the detail in there.
Right.
Let's take just a brief break and then let's get into extinction events.
Welcome back from the break, everybody. Now we're going to jump into mass extinction events, the episode topic. Now, we're going to cover five of the mass extinction events that happened over the last 500 million years, basically the what are considered to be the only mass extinction events on planet Earth. And then we will get into what extinction looks like today, the state of today's extinction, modern extinction,
state of the extinction.
The state of the unextinction. The first three of these events happened in what's called the Paleozoic era, and Paleozoic means ancient life. It's thought that because of these events, it's within this era that life was closest to leaving Earth for good. But we're still here. Obviously, you know that. So clearly life endured. Now, the reason there was so much life to be killed off in the first place at this time was because of something called the Cambrian Explosion, which happened about 500 million years ago. And the only thing you have to know about the Cambrian Explosion is that phytoplankton increased in the ocean, and that means more oxygen in the ocean. And when there's more oxygen, this is the theme of the episode, speciation, or the rate that species evolve, increases. So there's a bunch more oxygen, and that's when we started seeing kind of the first fish, even the first things with eyes. At that point, up until that point, life didn't even have eyes yet. So
I think when there's a lot of oxygen, also makes some pretty big animals. Animals get bigger, plants get bigger. Insects get bigger. That was the big thing, I think, that or why I know that fact is just because I remember, and snakes. I remember one snake was really big. There's an exhibit at a museum from my hometown where there's this, they had the size of this massive snake.
Interesting fact is that almost every major group of animals that exist today developed within the first 40 million years of the Cambrian. Cambrian explosion creates a crap ton of life 500 million years ago. But between then and now, we've had five giant extinction events where life was put to the test. And let's jump into the first.
The first one was called the End Ordovician. So a lot of these, the names of these mass extinction events are based on the period of life that was going on before the mass extinction event. So the End Ordovician ended the Ordovician time period of life. Little is known about what life was really on Earth before this event. We know that it was mostly marine life, because that's where life started. We believe it started down due to like underwater volcanoes, where there's a lot of materials being brought up from the crust and the mantle that were able to react with each other and grow some bacteria. But anyways, this mass extinction event was estimated to eliminate 85% of the species on Earth. So, and that number is debated, but that's pretty 85%, 75%,
right
around there.
That's a good nominal value for it, I think, yeah.
And the cause for this one is believed to be due to an ice age that lasted around a million years. So yeah. I think first, you know, we should talk about maybe what constitutes a mass extinction event. So,
oh, good point, yeah.
That's when there's a few different definitions. It's usually defined where 75% of the world's species were lost in a short geological time. And now a short geological time is going to sound like a long time to you and me, but for the Earth, not really a big deal. A short geological time period is around 3 million years.
Yeah.
Yeah, and so that's a long time. This one lasted around a million years, and that was due to an ice age. Things like carbon dioxide, methane, those greenhouse gases are the ones that are going to change the temperature on Earth. And so they might have caused the ice age was maybe a change in the levels of these gases.
Yeah, that's a huge theme across all these, as well as just those levels of greenhouse gases. Now, an interesting piece about the life during the Ordovician period is that this is when, so like Judd said, it's mostly marine life at this time, but this is when we started seeing the first actual fish, because although the life was marine before that, everything was basically glued to where it started. It lived and died in the same place, right? Or it floated with the water currents. But this is the first time we start seeing species that are able to propel themselves, which is pretty interesting. However, yeah, like Judd said, it was basically an 8-degree drop in global temperatures, which is incredibly significant. But this is over between, like Judd said, about a million-year ice age. So let's land there. The interesting thing about that is since the industrial or pre-industrial times on our planet, temperatures globally have risen about 1.9 degrees Fahrenheit since 1880. So 2 degrees Fahrenheit.
It's a large temperature change given the short period of time compared to this a million year temperature change of 8 degrees.
Yeah, significant. So the rate now is a lot greater, but we'll get into that a little later. Anyway, so that ends us with the Ordovician period, a giant freeze, basically. Also, when global temperatures drop, and that means a drop in sea levels, seawater levels, which is bad for things that are in the ocean. There's also speculation that because plants were starting to grow on land for the first time during this period, that they pulled too much CO2 out of the air because they were flourishing too much. Right? They have nothing eating them, so they're just unchecked growth. Now let's jump into the late Devonian crisis, so the next one, or you could call it the end Devonian extinction event. So what did life look like at this time? On land, we're finally seeing trees, so not just plants, but we have actual trees, canopies, and then because of the growth in trees, we also have insects showing up for the first time. And in the oceans, we have pretty much giant armored fish dominating the place, including the early ancestors to sharks. But from what I found, there's basically unknown causes of this event, save a drop in ocean oxygen levels, which, as we know, drop in oxygen levels means a lower rate of speciation. When you drop the rate at which you're able to evolve, species die out.
Yeah. One potential cause that I found was there might have been some runoff from land. So a lot of these new land species, due to the changes in sea levels and things like that, they might have been getting runoff into the ocean. So those nutrients were then taken up by these algae, which had a big algae bloom that took a lot of oxygen from the air and then produced maybe those greenhouse gases, which made it hotter and lowered speciation, things like that.
After this mass extinction event, life had a pretty awesome recovery for the most part. For example, insects, like Judd was kind of getting at earlier with the snakes and stuff, insects started to get ginormous. You never think about a bug as big, but we're talking the size of a human kind of thing, or larger, you know. Anyway, so humongous bugs and also tetrapods started to lay their legs on land. Both lay their eggs and their legs on land.
Oh,
if you don't know what tetrapods are, if you look it up, you'll recognize the picture immediately. But they, you know, amphibious looking reptiles, and they finally start crawling out of the shallows and putting their eggs on land, which is kind of that switch to having large four-legged creatures on the continents. Tucked in between this mass extinction and the next one, there was a supercontinent that was being formed. I think it was Gondwana. Like I said earlier, trees had finally started to get their start. Unfortunately, that also meant that when the supercontinent formed, the trees that were in the middle of this region had a hard time getting water transported from the oceans into the middle of the supercontinent. And so it basically became a super, super dry desert that was home to very little life. And this is actually a period known as the Carboniferous Rainforest Collapse. So that was another, like, I guess you could call it a minor plant extinction event or something like that. But that kind of leads us into the third extinction event.
But this one is the big dog.
Yeah, this, oh yeah. Oh, we're on number three. Yeah, this is the big dog.
Yeah.
I'm letting you take the big
dog.
All
right, so the big dog is the end Permian extinction. This is the big one, so they nicknamed it the Great Dying. The largest mass extinction event out of these five, and it wiped out 95% of all life on Earth. This was the first extinction event that affected insects. So that's kind of how you know. Some of those insects are just, you can't really get rid of them, you know? But if they're dying out,
and they're
out,
small, like they don't take up that much space in the ecosystem, you know, but if they're, yeah, exactly.
Yeah, think of a cockroach or a mosquito, you know. You just can't do anything to really get rid of them.
They can live in your house, in the worst parts of your house. They can live outside. They'll be fine, but no.
So if they're dying, that's how you know it's bad.
Yeah, I think, so I mentioned in the last period, land life, starting with the tetrapods, started to expand or was on the rise. And now at this point, right before this extinction event, we had what were known as stem mammals. So reptiles that were showing characteristics of like pre-mammals, basically, that were getting basically as large as cattle. So cattle-sized reptiles hanging out on inland Pangaea. So the reason that continental life was affected is because there was actually a giant ecosystem. Finally, for the first time, we have life on land. These extinction events include what's going on there as well. So
animals were super large, like we said earlier, was because of high oxygen levels. And before this extinction event, Oxygen levels were around 30%. And for reference, today is about 21%. So you might not think that's a big deal, but this is the entire atmosphere we're talking about. So this is a large deal. And kind of the reason for this extinction event was this drop from 30% oxygen levels to 10%, which is extremely low. Think of, you know, you're living on Mount Everest, but that's at sea level. And so...
So imagine Mount Everest, which didn't exist yet, but yeah. What's funny about this extinction event is not only was there a drop in oxygen levels, some scientists at NASA believe that this was compounded with an impact from a meteorite. So we had some teams who visited Hungary, Japan, and China, where there's still rocks that date back to this period. And what they found in these rocks is isotopes of argon and helium, which are more common in space or in space rocks than they are here on Earth. So they're thinking there was a collision that scattered this debris around the planet. And as we'll get into later with the extinction event you guys have probably all thought about, asteroid events really rock the whole world. Also compounding the meteorite impact is the time when what's known as the Siberian Traps region was formed. That's just like a bunch of volcanic rock from volcanic eruptions. So they had that going on for them as well. So you can see how this became the Great Dying pretty quickly from a lot of factors.
Yeah, and so then after the Great Dying, we had the Triassic mass extinction event. This was 205 million years ago. And this one is the least understood of the five. So we don't necessarily know... We don't have a lot of information on what was going on at this time and or why this was caused. But like AJ mentioned, volcanic activity plays a pretty big role. It can be really dangerous. And that's kind of the main cause for the Triassic one. And we're not sure, but we believe that's why, because there was a lot of dangerous chemicals in the atmosphere at this time.
Yeah. The fossil record is not like evenly distributed. So it can be the fourth and so second most recent extinction event, but we can have very little information about it just because of, you know, what the rocks have provided for us to sift through many, many, many millions of years later. So yeah, not a lot is known about the fourth extinction event.
Now to the one that you probably all know and love, the Cretaceous.
You said no.
Cretaceous.
Yes.
Now to the one that you all love and know and love. the Cretaceous. The end Cretaceous extinction event.
Yeah.
This was the massive asteroid impact, an asteroid of upwards of a trillion tons of rock impacting the Earth, which led to the killing of the dinosaurs.
Yeah, this is the, oh no, no way. If you look up the you've said this on past episodes. If you look up the Chicxulub crater in the Yucatan Peninsula, if you look that up, a meteor cuts across your screen on Google.
Yeah, that's pretty cool.
Anyway, yeah, so the Chicxulub crater was created from this impact. It's 180 kilometers in diameter, but it's more than just the fact that an asteroid hit the Earth that causes death in these situations. Aftermath of the collision kind of looked like an ejector cloud, first of all, of molten hot ash spreading out at 16,000 kilometers per hour, so the fastest and hottest wind you'd ever feel in your entire life would race towards you and then linger there, baking the planet for many years to come. And we had extreme magnitude earthquakes resulting from the shockwave of the initial impact traveling through the ground. And then also, I think there were even an impact like this can basically electrify the atmosphere and cause severe storms as well. So stormy weather.
Yeah. The asteroid was really just kind of the end of a lot of, like, there was another mass extinction event kind of already taking place before this asteroid impact. But the asteroid was just kind of the last
icing on the cake.
Yeah, so yeah. It kind of tipped the scale and made everything happen. We believe that there was already kind of a rise in temperatures going on at this time. And then the asteroid impact just kind of came and wiped everything out. So maybe we saved us. Maybe this mass extinction event that was going on before the asteroid impact was worse than the asteroid. And maybe the asteroid actually saved us.
Oh, you're saying because it just reset life like real quick? It was just like, we need to start over. Yeah, I see what you're saying.
It could have saved us. I don't know.
If everything didn't go exactly how it did, none of us would be here.
What's that? Just the, what is that called? Like the flap of a butterfly's wings on one side.
The butterfly effect.
Yeah, the butterfly effect. That's what
you were like so close. You said butterfly.
It was on the tip of my tongue.
Anyway, so that is the fifth and final extinction event, which leads us into the question, and you know, it's been 66 million years since the dinosaurs went extinct. how soon are we due here? We're ready to burst. We're pregnant with an extinction event.
Oh boy.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, we don't really know for sure when the next one is going to take place. However, we kind of believe that we may be the start of one. Human race might have just ticked off the next mass extinction event. Because like we were talking about earlier, the rise in temperatures due to our industrial revolution have been very rapid compared to even these other mass extinction events. And so
it's not just a planet driven cycle of life like the other ones were.
Yeah. And so kind of in my research of trying to figure out, are we in a sixth mass extinction event? I came across a video that I guess I knew about before, but I came across it again, called Man versus Earth on YouTube by Prince EA. And so I thought that this was a pretty interesting video that kind of puts things in perspective of maybe the danger that we pose to the Earth and how we can try to just explain that we really should try to work towards saving the Earth. Or the perspective that the video gives you is that the planet Earth is 4.5 billion years old. And so then there's the exact date of how old mankind is. It's kind of highly debated, but the normal consensus is that mankind is about 140,000 years old. So that means if we take that 4.5 billion year old lifespan of the Earth and condense it into one human day of 24 hours, we would be alive on Earth for a whopping 3 seconds.
Let's go.
So that's quite a very short time.
Yeah.
And so in less than the time that it takes to watch a TikTok video, we've created these rapid extinction events that are the rapid extinction of multiple species that wouldn't have taken place.
It's not supposed to happen this fast.
Yeah. And so one thing, I guess, to preface is there is a natural rate of extinction.
I forgot to mention that earlier. Yeah. It's so 1 in 10,000 every 100 years.
For every 1 year, if there's a million species on Earth, one should go extinct, kind of in this natural rate of maybe they're a local species. So maybe there's some local, you know, like a landslide or a volcano eruption or something like that that wipes out a species. Or it could just be
they couldn't evolve fast enough.
They couldn't evolve fast enough. Yeah, things like that. So there is a natural rate of extinction. However, we're going at about 100 to 1,000 times faster than that natural rate today. So these last couple of years, instead of losing just one per million, we're losing 100 or 1,000 per million. And so that's a lot of species. And I think the impact of losing these species isn't necessarily the fact that we lost that species. It's that it's going to create kind of a domino effect, because if you lose one leg in that food chain, you're going to lose the next leg. And so things can speed up very quickly.
Yeah. No one species is independent of everything else on the planet. Right. Exactly. Yeah. So even if it seems small, it definitely makes an impact. Now, just for statistics that I collected on human impact on the planet, 70% of all land has been transformed, and 3/4 of all freshwater resources are now being used. And part of this non-regenerative resource use can drive extinction of species. There's also a disproportionate effect on just the species that we have hunted in the past, because most of the species that we hunt end up being large predatory animals because they're seen as either a risk to humans or a risk to livestock. I'm not saying that I want wolves running rampant or whatever, giant eagles or whatever. My point is basically, while we have driven some animals close to extinction, in the past we have been successful with at least sustaining them or bringing them back from the brink of extinction. For example, the one that comes to mind is bison. So by 1889, based on all the hunting of bison that was going on in the Great American Plains, we kind of brought their numbers down to just a couple hundred. But just from those hundred, over several decades, the National Fish and Wildlife Service have brought that back up to millions.
So. Yeah. And I think maybe one thing that some people ask is, why should I care? You know, why should I care if there's a few species going extinct? How does that affect me? And so I think something to realize is it maybe doesn't directly affect you, but if there's a species that goes extinct, let's say there's a fish species that goes extinct in the ocean. Maybe that fish species eats a lot of these algaes that we talked about earlier that could cause a mass extinction event, because they could use up a ton of oxygen in the air, and then that's going to make you live like you're on Mount Everest all the time. And if they're taking oxygen, chances are they're expelling CO2, which is going to go into the atmosphere and make things hotter. And I think, so there might, maybe it's not going to be a direct impact on you, but these are things that we need to think about and, you know, prevent, because they will have an impact on us later.
I've heard this before from environmental scientists. Like, for the most part, these environmental scientists aren't saying, nobody's saying that like we need to set Earth up to be this just sustainable haven for all of eternity. Because it's like the humans aren't even going to be around in a couple million years. You know, that doesn't matter. You know, and these natural these extinction events sometimes are just unavoidable. But the fact of the matter is, like we talked about at the start, the rate at which things are happening due to what we're doing is significantly faster. So if you do want to make things better for you and the people who will exist after us, like Judd said, in a very short amount of time, if we condense that down to a day, you know, these people that are our next door neighbors in life, you know, down the way, we need to be changing our actions now. It's not about making the Earth perfect and balanced or whatever. It's about making sure that humans can exist. It's okay to think selfishly about it in this situation, but you do have to think, we're not trying to save the environment and save the world all because of these animals and stuff. We have to help people recognize that it will have an impact on us and everybody around us. We're trying to save humans and make things better for humans and improve the life for us in the short term, even by making these changes. It's not just about the long term.
Yeah, I think we're definitely a very greedy or self-centered species, which is, it doesn't have to necessarily be a bad thing. I mean, it also drives, you know, sort of innovations that we're going to need to save ourselves and things like that.
For real.
Another thing that came out of this video, something that I guess I learned that I didn't know, is that Homo sapiens, the name that we've given ourselves, means wise man. And so then the video kind of asked you, do you really believe that we are wise? You know, I think it's something to think about because we've been alive on the earth for a whopping 3 seconds. I think wisdom is something that comes with time and isn't necessarily something that you gain right away.
Yeah, you're not just inherently wise.
Yeah, and I think there's a difference between being smart and being wise. I think we're definitely a very smart species. I mean, we've split the atom.
Yeah.
And we've sent rockets.
We've learned how to make clothes for Shein at a rapid pace.
Oh, now that's, you know, awesome.
That's smart. Smart people need to be able to do that, but maybe that's not wise. Yeah. Dude, I was just going to say, in case you're reluctant to accept some of the information about extinction events because they happened hundreds of millions of years ago, you're like, how do people even know that these things happen? What's the data? Well, I was curious about this too. Apparently, you know, our fossil record that we've collected, at least at the Smithsonian Museum, they have a collection of over 40 million fossils already, you know.
That's
40 million. I thought it was just going to be like, you know, tens of thousands of like fossils of species, but somewhere we're collecting like all the bones. We're literally writing the history of life in these catalogs of fossils. So we have plenty of evidence. All we have to look for is we see it here in this level of the rock, and then if you inch up a little bit, it vanishes, and we can extrapolate from there, you know.
Yeah, that's kind of how we can tell, you know, if the species is dying out, is they're not going to show up in the fossils anymore. You're not going to find them. I think to put things into perspective, for a closing thought, another statistic that the video mentions is how rare it is, or how the chances of humans being alive today. And there's a lot of different lenses that you could look at this through. You could look at it through, you know, the Goldilocks effect, or the Goldilocks zone, where we're in the spot where water doesn't freeze, but it doesn't boil either, and things like that. But, and you could also look at it, what's the chance of you individually being born today when there's, you know, all these other things that could have happened. It says that we are one in a billion trillion trillion. That means a one followed by 33 zeros. And so the chances of us being here are so slim. We need to use that and carry that on and say, hey, this is a big deal. And so we need to work together to make it to the fourth second.
Yeah. I mean, it took us 500 million years of evolution just to get to humans. Right. So it'd be a shame to knock us out in a short period of time. Anyway, that wraps up our episode on mass extinction events, which means we should jump into a listener shout out. For today, our listener shout out is Jordan from Bulgaria. Jordan's message is, love the podcast. My favorite episode has to be How Computers Work, Math or Magic. I like how you guys start off with news and brain games. Very unique. An episode on quantum entanglement would be very interesting. And that episode is certainly in the works, but we want to make sure we do that right.
Yeah, that one's definitely a tough one, one that we want to get right. So we've been
putting
it off. I think we've been putting it off for too long. I think it's going to be coming soon.
Yeah. I'd love to have I'd love to have someone come in and talk to us about that even too.
Yeah, it'd be nice if we could find somebody more knowledgeable than us, but
I mean, we're wise. We're wise, but we need someone smart, it sounds
right,
like.
Right.
He has a special message. He says, "You guys clearly have a passion for this. Keep doing what you're doing. I also love the nonchalant and unscripted unscripted vibe of the podcast." Thanks, Jordan.
Yeah, thank you very much.
We appreciate listeners like you. If it's whether it's you or a friend or my parents or whatever saying like, "Good job," makes it very hard to put this podcast to the side. There are plenty of others like Jordan in Bulgaria who are listening right now. And if you're listening to this, we trust that you are also one of the wise people, not just smart people, but wise people who will put this perspective of this episode to good use. So enjoy. That about wraps it up. We will see you guys in 2 weeks to talk about another topic we haven't talked about yet.
Three, two,
peace.
One.